It's 1240. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. It's been a roller coaster ride for Spain's economy this week. There are fears that Spain lacks the money to rescue its own troubled banks and may need Europe's help. Madrid did hold a successful bond auction Thursday, and markets responded, but only until the Fitch Ratings Agency downgraded Spain's debt rating several hours later. Plans are afoot for a European banking union, and that could be a long-term solution to Spain's banking crisis. But as Lauren Freyer reports, Madrid might need some kind of aid a lot sooner than that.
At a bond auction Thursday, investors were hungry for Spanish debt. Demand was more than triple the supply. It shows investors still want to hold Spanish bonds long term. Economist Gonzalo Garland at Madrid's IE Business School says the European Commission has proposed a banking union after watching Spain struggle to prop up its own banks.
A system where there will be direct supporting of banks that are failing in Europe, which will not apply for Spain now, but will be applied in the future. So in a way, it will avoid or at least try to control the situations in the future.
This banking union, if approved by member states, would prevent situations like Spain's. It probably won't be in place until 2015, too late for Spain, which the IMF estimates needs some $50 billion for its banks, quick. So Spain is angling for a short-term fix, an infusion of cash from either one of Spain's rescue funds or the European Central Bank. That's the fastest way, says economist Rolf Campos at Spain's IESE Business School.
Normally, things that are done by central banks move much faster than anything that has to go through Congress or Parliament. So in this case, the best thing that can happen to Spain is that we get a solution that comes out of the European Central Bank.
Even if the money does come from the ECB, which would be quicker, other countries like Germany would have to approve it. But there are signs Berlin may be warming to the idea. After all, six of its own banks were downgraded this week. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Madrid.
We're going to hear now about a small label that has managed to record some of the most interesting artists around. Adele, the reigning queen of the Grammy Awards, Vampire Weekend, a big indie success story, and XX, two young Brits with one of the most buzzed about bands in the world. All of these acts are based out of a small house in London. NPR's Jacob Gans has this profile of the tiny but powerful XL Recordings.
Leave aside the music itself for a moment. If you're going to go by XL's example, to make a mark on the music industry, you need a strong philosophy and a willingness to break rules. Actually, no, don't leave aside the music.
The music's got to be great, it's got to be sold as well as possible, and everyone's got to get paid. Those to me are the kind of three things.
That's Richard Russell, the man who co-founded XL in 1989. And yep, XL's owner has a three-part checklist for success, except he wants nothing to do with parts two and three.
I think if I had to be involved in those other things, I would stop doing the job. I really don't want to be involved in those other things. I want to be involved in music, because that's why I sort of did this in the first place.
Russell did this, started XL, so that he could put out 12-inch vinyl singles for British rave DJs.
Charlie says, always tell your mummy before you go off somewhere.
But over 20 years, XL has grown into a different animal. Not just in sound, but in scope. Last year, it put out an album that spawned three chart-topping singles and won six Grammys. It hasn't left the Billboard top 10 in 67 consecutive weeks.
She ain't real. She ain't gonna be able to love you like I will. She is a stranger. You and I have history, or don't you remember?
Adele's 21 is the biggest selling new album of the last 7 years.
Yeah, that's crazy. Who would have thought that?
That's Ezra Koenig from the New York band Vampire Weekend. His bandmate Rostam Botmongli is the one laughing in the background. Vampire Weekend signed with XL in 2007. 3 years later, the band's second album hit number one. Lead singer Ezra Koenig says XL's British office is the farthest thing you could imagine from a major label operation.
Their office in London is literally an old house. So when you walk in, you're literally in this like cozy house, and it's like there's stuff all over the walls and like little murals, and it's like very communal. And Richard has this kind of big, very personally decorated office. but people are always, like, having meetings in there and, like, hanging out on the couches.
XL also has an office in the United States. It's run by Chris Chen, a 40-year-old indie label veteran. With successes like Adele and Vampire Weekend, XL could hire more staff, put out more records, but Chen says there are no plans to do that.
It is a better result to devote the maximum time possible to the fewest number of records. And so I think for 2012, we maybe have 5 records this year.
Chen's New York operation has only 3 full-time staffers, but as part of Beggars Group, a company that includes 3 other independent labels, XL can share the workload when it comes to distribution, manufacturing, and promotion of records. But when it came to Adele, XL needed more. The label released her first album, 19, on its own in England. But for the U.S. market, which is much larger, XL signed a distribution deal with Columbia Records, a major label. Chris Chen says there was one reason.
Radio is perhaps one of the toughest worlds to play in, and we have a small radio department. And someone like Columbia simply has more records that work in a commercial radio world.
That same philosophy. Know your limitations, work with people who can do things you can't, and let them do their job. Extends to the records made by XL's musicians, says Vampire Weekend's Rostam Batmongli.
Richard is a producer himself, so the idea that he would tell a band what to do, I think he would find that as ridiculous as anyone. He believes in his artist's creativity, and I think that is the secret to XL's success.
And that brings us back to Russell's 3-part checklist. These days, he spends as much time as he can actually making music. A few years ago, Russell decided he'd like to hear a new Gil Scott-Heron record, so he convinced the musician to go into a studio where Russell produced Scott-Heron's final album. Then last summer, Russell recorded an album in the Democratic Republic of Congo with Damon Albarn of the bands Blur and Gorillaz. Albarn had previously worked with the gospel and soul veteran Bobby Womack, and Russell says the 3 men decided to go into a studio to see what would happen.
We were able to sort of create a feeling and create ideas, and we were writing and recording like that. But while we were doing that, I think we were also hitting on a sound which was the combination of the live instrumentation with the drum machine.
The result was The Bravest Man in the Universe. The album comes out next week on XL.
I got a story I want to tell. Gather around me. Gather around me, boys and girls.
The label is an artistic endeavor for me, and often that endeavor is purely to do with creating a platform for other people to be artistic, but the right platform.
That includes musicians without as much experience as Womack or as much mainstream success as Adele or Vampire Weekend. The British electronic producer Jay Paul was signed to XL in 2010 on the strength of one song he posted on his MySpace page. 2 years later, he's released just one more song. Both singles attracted the kind of attention online that would make another label drool with anticipation. But Richard Russell isn't worried about Jay Paul's pace.
Jay is a wizard, and the way he's going about things is, I think, for many, baffling. But it's how he's going about things. And as such, it can only be right, because it's his way of doing it. He's going about things in the most Jay Paul way you could possibly go about things. And who knows where that will lead.
Wherever that happens to be, XL's small army seems likely to be ready for it. For NPR News, I'm Jacob Gans.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Risk Management Commodities, Lafayette, Indiana; Milo's in Urbana and Escobar's in Champaign; and Unitarian Universalist Church of Urbana-Champaign. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 8th of June, 2012. It was 150 years ago today, 1862, Emily Dickinson wrote a letter to Thomas Wentworth Higginson asking him to read her poems. He was a Unitarian minister. He was an essayist. He'd written an essay for the Atlantic Monthly called Letter to a Young Contributor, giving advice to aspiring writers. Emily Dickinson read that article and wrote to Higginson and asked if he would comment on her poems. We don't know what he wrote back to her, but we do know that she wrote to him, "Thank you for the surgery. It was not so painful as I supposed." and this began a correspondence that would last the rest of her life. He only met her twice. He advised her not to publish her poems. She thought they were too unconventional. But after she died, he co-edited two volumes of her work. He did edit them. He tried to standardize her punctuation, her grammar, which to us now seems a shameful thing. But his co-editor wanted to revise them even more. And Higginson said, "Let us alter as little as possible." It was on this date, 1867, Mark Twain set out on a trip to Europe and the Middle East. He was just starting out as a writer. He'd only published one book, The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County. He was living in New York. He was working as a travel writer for the San Francisco Alta California. And he told them that if they would fund his trip, he'd write 50 letters home for publication. And they agreed, so he set off on a steam-driven sidewheeler, Quaker City, with a big group of American tourists. Conventional travel books at the time talked about what you should see on your trip, but none of them talked about the nitty-gritty of taking a trip. So that's what Twain wrote about. He wrote about all the little annoyances and about culture shock. And then he came home and he took 6 months to convert his newspaper columns into a 600-page book, The Innocents Abroad, or The New Pilgrim's Progress. Mark Twain wrote, "In Paris, they just simply opened their eyes and stared when we spoke to them in French. We never did succeed in making those idiots understand their own language." He wrote, "As far as I can see, Italy for 1,500 years has turned all her energies, all her finances, and all her industry to the building up of a vast array of wonderful church edifices and starving half her citizens to accomplish it. She is today one vast museum of magnificence and misery." Innocents Abroad was Mark Twain's best-selling book in his lifetime. It was one of the best-selling travel books of all time. Here's a poem for today by Linda Paston entitled Emily Dickinson. We think of her hidden in a white dress among the folded linens and sachets of well-kept cupboards, or just out of sight, sending jellies and notes with no address to all the wondering, amorous neighbors, eccentric as